So I'm here with Sir Dermot Turing, acclaimed author and nephew of Alan Turing. So Dermot, would it be true to say that Alan Turing directly helped the Allies to win World War II? And if yes, how so?
Well, all right, there's a bit of a myth here. This tells us more about British psychology than it does about Alan Turing, I think. The thing is that what we're all very proud in Britain of what Bletchley Park achieved during World War II, cracking the German ciphers and providing intelligence to military commanders, which I think made a huge difference to the way that they were able to conduct their forces in the field and at sea. So, yes, Bletchley Park certainly made a difference. Here's where the psychology comes in, though, because we love to funnel all that pride into one hero. I've got a horrible revelation for you and your audience, which is that more than one person worked at Bletchley Park. And yeah. Worse, Alan Turing didn't work at Bletchley Park after the end of 1942. So we've got to re-examine that myth a bit. There were 10,000 people working at Bletchley Park at its peak towards the end of the war. And there were many people who had lots of brilliant, bright ideas about code cracking. There was more than one code. There's another horrible revelation. People won't want to know that there were things other than Enigma. Alan Turing had a big role in the Enigma story, but certainly not the only role. And without the contributions of others, the speedy, efficient, very practical solutions to Enigma that were able to be turned around, churned out in a factory-style manner. He was not responsible for that kind of delivery, even though he had some of the bright ideas that led to that becoming possible. So I think we have to try and sort of have a good perspective on what he did there and remember that there were other codes, other brilliant people, people who had different skills from Alan Turing and therefore could bring to life what came out of his ideas. And then the other thing I think we have to remember is that Alan Turing didn't do all his invention on his own. You know, so what we call Alan Turing's clever ideas didn't just spring into his head from nowhere. They were developments of ideas that other people had suggested to him, and in particular, the preliminary work done in Poland by the Polish code breakers and the machinery that they had invented to tackle the Enigma problem. And he was just extending and developing that, albeit in very brilliant and clever ways. I don't want to sort of dismiss that, but perhaps it's an overstatement to say it annoys me, but somehow it discredits the others when we say that World War II was won by Alan Turing. I mean, that sort of conflates all sorts of things that we know not to be true. and it discredits the other guys at Bletchley Park. And it perhaps also discredits those people who actually fought the battles, because they're the ones who won World War II, albeit with some helpful intelligence provided by some non-combatant people working in England.
Yeah. So you mentioned Bletchley Park there. I know you've got a book out called The Codebreakers of Bletchley Park. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah. I think perhaps this is a good thing, because publishers of the book thought that it would be a good thing to have an opportunity to celebrate the lives of some of the other people. I mean, not trying to somehow whitewash Alan Turing out of the picture altogether, and he has a prominent role in it, but to give an opportunity to showcase some of the others and what they did, and to show the diversity, if you like, of not just the people at Bletchley Park, but also the things that they did. And also it's an opportunity to retell the story. Let me just explain about that for a minute. I think, again, we've sanctified Bletchley Park slightly, and therefore it must be a place where nothing went wrong and all the relationships between all the people were uniformly harmonious, and these splendid chaps just turned out this marvelous product. Actually, it's more exciting than that. It's not quite as dull as all these people sort of getting along famously all the time. There were internecine wars going on all the time. There were famously, there was one occasion when the chief executive basically got fired. There were rows about all sorts of things, including the introduction of machinery and how the place was going to be managed and the relationship between the military and the civil sides of the organization, the difficulty of getting resources for a secret organization. There's lots of tension there. Lots of catty stories by some of the codebreakers about some of the others. And so it's an opportunity to try and sort of, bring a slightly more colorful picture, because, you know, without those human tensions and the sort of slightly unusual variety of people that we had there, I think it perhaps becomes a bit duller than it could be.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's lots there that a lot of people wouldn't really know about. I've read that Turing himself could be quite eccentric while working at Bletchley Park. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, I think that's true. Though again, we perhaps need to put some perspective on it. So there's a story I was just reading the other day, actually, by one of Alan Turing's co-workers at Bletchley Park, a mathematician called Peter Hilton, who I actually met in the 1990s. He's a delightful guy. I'm afraid no longer with us, as is true with so many of the Bletchley Park folks. But he tells the story about Alan Turing's bicycle. Alan Turing didn't need to lock his bike up because the chain on the bike was broken. And after so many revolutions of the pedals, then the chain would come off and probably knock the rider off. This was great because Alan knew entirely how the relevant link coming into connection with the relevant spoke and exactly what point in the cycle journey that would happen, and so was prepared for it and took suitable action. Most people thought this was just completely and utterly eccentric, because why wouldn't you just go and get the wretched thing fixed? Yeah. But he thought, no, I don't need to go and get it fixed, because it doesn't actually cause me a particular problem, because I can predict exactly when the problem is going to arise, and it means I don't have to lock my bike, because everybody knows that my bike is bust. So then nobody wants to nick my bike. So this is sort of, you know, it's kind of logical, but it's kind of like not the way that the rest of us would approach the thing.
Yeah.
Just to put some context around, I mean, that's just one of several stories about Alan Turing. And there are stories about other code breakers at Bletchley Park. There were quite a few eccentric folks there. Those eccentricities, I think, came to the surface because when the story of Bletchley Park and its achievements first became known in the mid-70s, the government was still very sensitive about what could and could not be told about Bletchley Park. And the idea was that when people were first allowed to write their reminiscences of Bletchley Park, they were not allowed to talk about any code-breaking techniques, and they're only allowed to talk in very general terms about what the intelligence product that Bletchley Park had produced was. So what was there left to talk about? Well, there really wasn't much other than, well, you know, there was this splendid chap from Cambridge and he was a mathematics professor and he dressed badly and he did these eccentric things. And so we discovered all these slightly loony things that the codebreakers got up to, rather than in their personal habits, rather than in their actual achievements. And I think that's changed a bit, because we know a bit more about the sort of technical side of things now. But it does mean that the stories about the eccentricities were the first things to be published, and so they've kind of stayed with us. They've become the narrative of Bletchley Park in some way.
Wow. So obviously you've mentioned that Alan Turing wasn't alone at Bletchley Park. Can you tell us a bit more about the other people who worked there?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that this opportunity that this book created was to bring into the spotlight, into the limelight a bit, some of the other code breakers. I mean, Alan Turing really was hired as a mathematician rather than as a code breaker, and he had to sort of, you know, learn on the job, as it were, whereas there were some very impressive code-breaking characters there. And again, one of the myths of Bletchley Park is that the code-breakers were all tweedy men from universities, men of the professor type, to quote the phrase of the first head of Bletchley Park. And while there were lots of women there, in fact, it was well over half the Bletchley Park staff were women by the second half of World War II. The image that we have is that all the women working at Bletchley Park were young girls straight out of school who were drummed into the Women's Royal Naval Service and then sent to work on really tedious activities like operating bomb machines, which we used to find the settings on Enigma. That's kind of true, but it's kind of half true. And the peeling away the sort of half truth, what you discover is that there were lots of really quite interesting people doing really quite interesting jobs there. So to take the women thing for just to give one example. It turns out that the men of the professor type included quite a lot of women of the professor type. So there were actually women doing code-breaking jobs at Bletchley, contrary to what our picture is. The reason it's confusing is that in the official records, women code-breaking roles were men's jobs because everything was genderized in those days. So if you were a woman code-breaker, you couldn't be a code breaker because that was a man's job. So your job description was something like translator or clerical staff or something like that. So you go and look at the records and you say, oh, look, there are all these women and they're doing typing. No, they weren't. They were doing code breaking, but they couldn't be called code breakers because that was a description of a man's job. So it's really, really confusing. But then when you actually talk to the women or you read their memoirs that they wrote when they were allowed to years later, you discover that they were doing really quite astonishing things and they were working alongside men, and it was really much less segregated and compartmentalized along gender lines than we've been used to thinking. So again, you know, that's just one example of sort of how being able to talk about the other people at Bletchley Park has been sort of revealed some new stories about the place.
Yeah, it sounds like there's lots of amazing work going on by lots of different people. Why would you say it's taken so long for other people at Bletchley Park to get the recognition they deserve?
Yeah, that's really difficult. I mean, we know that there's been this sort of almost obsessive kind of official secrecy over the place. I have to say, I don't think I still, I mean, even though I've been thinking and writing about Bletchley Park for many years, I don't think I really still got my head around why the secrecy is so persistent. Let me just, perhaps it's tedious, but just spend 1 minute doing a timeline on it. So the idea that Enigma had been broken and that the Allies had been reading German codes sort of seeped out, leaked out, if you like, in the late 1960s and early 1970s, but not in the UK. But then some historians had begun to twig what was going on, and there were a couple of historians planning to write books in the mid-70s, at which point the UK government decided, uh-oh, we better get out ahead of the news, and semi-authorised this chap who had been loosely connected with Bletchley Park, called Group Captain Winterbottom, and they sort of allowed him to publish his account, which was very vague on the technical details and not entirely accurate on the non-technical ones. And so we got this beautiful sort of myth about Bletchley Park, but that sold like millions of copies. I mean, literally millions of copies, because everybody wanted to get the full, get this story sort of essentially from the horse's mouth. So that was great. But we were still very short on technical detail. And then what happened is that some of the guys thought, well, hang on, if Winterbottom's been allowed to write his book, then surely we can write our stuff. So some people started writing more technical things, including Alan Turing's co-worker, Gordon Welshman. Gordon Welshman had his security clearance removed because he told people how Enigma had been broken. Enigma was by then 30 years obsolete. Nobody could realistically have been using Enigma machines for sending secret messages in the mid-70s, early 80s. I mean, it's just nonsense. So why that was still a secret is still incomprehensible to me. And it goes on. Gradually, things have been declassified by GCHQ, and so lots of material that you can go and look at in the National Archives and also in the US National Archives. So there's lots of stuff that has been dribbled out to us, but still there's stuff that's classified. So for example, there's a report on a bomb machine that the Americans were developing, which Alan Turing wrote in 1943. I've had to ask for that to be declassified to be allowed to look at it, assuming that somebody's still got a copy of it, that is. But, so I know that the document was prepared, but, there's stuff that, is still not available for researchers to look at. It's very, very strange. Don't understand why we have all this continuing secrecy.
Yeah, it's really fascinating stuff. Sounds like there's a lot yet still to be unearthed.
Well, it's very difficult to imagine that any of it could still be sensitive. One thing I can fully understand and sympathize with is that if somebody wrote an account that could put the lives of somebody and their families in danger because it mentions certain names in certain contexts, I can fully see that that's stuff that you probably want to keep under wraps for quite a long time. But frankly, technical details about code-breaking machinery that is never going to have any modern-day relevance doesn't seem to fall into that category.
Yeah. moving slightly away from Bletchley Park, so around this time of year in Manchester, we'd normally celebrate Pride and would be doing if it weren't for the COVID-19 pandemic. Can you tell us a little bit more about Turing's sexuality and how it impacted his life, his death and his legacy?
Yes. I don't want to disappoint everybody. I'm not going to tell you that actually Alan Turing was a hetero and we've got all that horribly wrong. But I think perhaps if we try and imagine ourselves back in the 1940s and 1950s, life was very different, and particularly for gay folks, gay men, it was very difficult. And so people tended to conceal their sexuality in a way that more or less we don't have to do these days. So I'm not going to try and pretend that I believe to you that everything is completely solved, but we've come a long way. So that meant that very few people actually knew about Alan Turing's sexuality. Only his closest, most intimate circle of friends knew about it. And so I think, there's a sort of a, because he's kind of become a bit of a gay hero, I think that means that we might imagine that he was kind of a gay hero in his own lifetime, which I think would not be true. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that people in Manchester should have anything other than huge pride and respect for essentially one of their sons who, happened to be gay. But I don't think his life was actually defined by his sexuality, mm-hmm. at least not until that fateful time, which we all know about, where he got arrested and prosecuted and then sent off for what seems like very barbaric hormone treatment Treatment for what? I mean, this is the bizarre thing. So if you'll excuse me, I'd like to do, just to give you my own take on that whole
thing. Of course.
It's very, very strange. Alan Turing was offered essentially an escape route out of prison and a way to avoid getting a criminal record and thereby a way to keep his job at Manchester University, which was to be, instead of being fined or sent to prison, which basically all the other gay folks who were being tried on the same day as him, you know, he wasn't the only case by any stretch of the imagination. It was like the daily bread of the courts. So he was given this opportunity to escape all that by being put on probation. But here's the funny thing. He was put on probation under the section of the legislation that deals with people who are suffering from a mental condition. You know, on the principle that, you know, if you're insane, then you can't be guilty. So therefore you can be sent off to be treated by a suitably qualified medical practitioner. So that's what happened to him. He was treated as if he was insane and sent off for psychotherapy. But of course, there wasn't anything mentally wrong with him. So what did they have to do? Well, first of all, they had to find out what was wrong with him. And they found out that he had homosexuality, which was being treated as some form of mental illness. And so the hormone therapy was designed to essentially to suppress his sexuality. And it's the most extraordinary kind of thing. I mean, a world where science is being distorted in such a way. I mean, it's fake science. It's all designed to reinforce society's prejudices, and really quite alarming, frankly. We think we've come a long way since the 1950s, and we don't think about things that way anymore. But there are countries in the world, and even countries actually in Europe, where homosexuality is still regarded as some form of mental illness or a lifestyle choice, and either therefore it leads you down a criminal path or it leads you down a mental illness path. I have to say, I find that quite appalling. To, you know, that's still the case in some places in 2020. So, to come back to Alan Turing and Pride and Manchester, I'm delighted that if what his example allows us to do is to think about these things and to try and do something to make the plight of other folks who are still suffering under these crazy ideas that prevail in other parts of the world and make their lives better. If we can do that, that's a great thing.
Yeah, definitely. Completely agree. So in this episode, we've been thinking about our favourite Alan Turing facts. Just to finish, can I ask you what your favourite Alan Turing fact is?
There's lots to choose from, I guess people would sort of hope to have another sort of Alan Turing eccentricity story, but I'd like to do something slightly different, actually. One of the things that my father, so it's Alan Turing's brother, didn't find out about until probably around about the time of Alan's death was that for years and years, Alan Turing had been making payments to a lady called Hazel Ward. When my father and his brother were both children, they were sent to live with a foster family in the south coast of England. And the foster family had three daughters, who were very much older than my father and his brother. So they were late teens. And so Hazel was the youngest of these daughters. She was about 12 years older than Alan. But he'd stayed in touch with Hazel all his life. And that in itself was quite remarkable, because staying in touch with your sort of foster family, particularly with somebody who's quite a lot older than you, is sort of like remarkable. But Hazel was a missionary, and she was off in Africa, and I'm not sure which country, possibly the Gambia. But she had been doing sort of essentially charitable missionary type work in whichever African country it was. And of course, that's not paid. And Alan Turing had, out of his salary, he'd been making her basically maintenance payments for years and years and years. And I just find that that's extraordinary. And nobody knows that kind of thing about him. I just think it's so contrary to the picture that we have of Alan Turing from a certain movie that we haven't talked about yet, but of somebody who can't form human relationships and doesn't have any kind of understanding of anything beyond his own needs. That is so wrong as a portrayal of Alan that it's just nice to have the opportunity to talk about some other aspect of his character that people wouldn't know.
Definitely. Yeah, it's brilliant. I'm sure lots of people wouldn't know that side of him. Right, that's all the questions I've got. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're welcome.